Hello, this is Ed Reedy from the Talking Information Center with today's reading from Reuters. Trump's approval falls to 33%, lowest of his presidency, Reuters Ipsos poll finds, by Jason Lang. Washington. President Donald Trump's approval rating fell to the lowest level of his presidency, with an overwhelming majority of Americans concerned the U.S. war with Iran will last a long time, according to a Reuters Ipsos poll that concluded on Monday. Just 33% of respondents in the four-day survey said they approved of Trump's performance in the White House, while 64% disapproved. Trump's approval rating, down from 35% in a poll that closed earlier this month and lower than at any point in his current term, has now tied the lowest level of his prior term, reached in December 2017. After returning to the White House in 2025 with just under half the country approving of his presidency, Trump's popularity this year took a hit after he ordered strikes on Iran alongside U.S. ally Israel. The ensuing conflict paralyzed a fifth of the global oil trade, triggering a surge in the price of gasoline that is weighing on U.S. households and on Trump's Republican allies, defending congressional majorities in November's midterm elections. Trump, who campaigned on promises to keep inflation in check and avoid long-lasting wars, initially pledged the conflict with Iran would take a few weeks, but Iran has proved resilient and has kept the oil trade through the Strait of Hormuz largely bottled up, even as the conflict has cooled. Some 80% of Americans, including 87% of Democrats and 71% of Republicans, think U.S. involvement in Iran will go on for an extended period of time. The Reuters Ipsos poll found just 16% said the conflict would likely end in a few weeks. Trump justifies high gas prices. Trump told a political rally in Garden City, New York on Friday that paying a tiny little bit more for your gasoline is worth the cost of ensuring a very evil country could not have a nuclear weapon, one of his stated rationales for the war. Throughout the conflict, the president has alternated between threats of escalation and assertions that a peace deal is imminent. Only 1 in 5 Americans and just half of Republicans think the war has been worth it, the latest Reuters Ipsos poll found. Concerns about the war and gasoline prices have Republicans nervous about their hopes of defending their slim majority in the U.S. House of Representatives in the November 3rd elections, and Democrats increasingly see the U.S. Senate also within their grasp. Reuters Ipsos polling this month has shown voters prefer Democrats over Republicans as better stewards of the economy for the first time in about a decade. The latest poll shows 38% of voters think Democrats will handle the economy better, compared to 35% who prefer the Republican approach. Democrats are also seen as better equipped to manage the cost of living. The Republican approach to immigration has remained more popular than that of Democrats throughout Trump's term, with a sharp fall in border crossings and sustained nationwide crackdown ordered by Trump. But Republicans are losing ground amid deadly confrontations and a surge in detainees, including children. Some 40% of registered voters said Republicans have the better approach on immigration policy, compared to 38% who picked Democrats, according to the latest Reuters Ipsos poll. That 2 percentage point spread is the lowest of Trump's term. Republicans led by 26 points in January 2025. Who has the better approach to immigration? The Reuters Ipsos poll, which was conducted online, gathered responses from 1,166 U.S. adults nationwide and had a margin of error of 3 percentage points in either direction. Iran threatens to go on offensive in Strait of Hormuz if diplomacy with U.S. fails, by Pariza Havizi and Catherine Jackson. Dubai, and Washington. Iran will shift to a fully offensive military posture because efforts to negotiate permanent end of the war with the U.S. have stalled, a senior Iranian official told Reuters on Monday, as Washington ruled out extending a temporary ceasefire agreement. Progress toward peace talks and a resumption of oil tanker traffic through the strategic Strait of Hormuz has ground to a halt, with no sign that the warring parties are moving towards ending the conflict that the U.S. and Israel launched with attacks on Iran on February 28th. Iranian entities must be prepared to escalate tensions in the Strait of Hormuz and wider regions, as Iran will be ready to make decisions and take action on difficult decisions, the Iranian official said, adding that Tehran would conduct a timely and precise military attack to break the U.S. naval blockade if diplomacy failed. Monday marked the day by which Iran and the U.S. were expected to reach a final peace agreement under a memorandum of understanding signed in June and aimed at ending the war. Signed on June 17th, the memorandum of understanding set a 60-day time frame for the U.S. and Iran to reach a broader deal on Iran's nuclear program and U.S. sanctions. The agreement, which declared the immediate and permanent termination of military operations on all fronts, quickly unraveled over a dispute about control of the Strait of Hormuz, the narrow waterway through which a fifth of global oil and liquefied natural gas flowed before the war. Asked by reporters on Monday if the U.S. was seeking to extend June's interim agreement, U.S. President Donald Trump said no. Trump threatens to bomb Oman. Iran said point 5 of the Memorandum of Understanding gave it the right to manage the strait, which it shares with Oman. While the U.S. rejected that interpretation, hostilities resumed as Iran began firing on vessels it said were trying to sail through Hormuz on an unapproved route, and Trump said on July 7th that the pact was over. Within the short period of a few weeks set by Iran, all the agreement's provisions must be implemented by the U.S. This is a precondition for further negotiations with the U.S., the Iranian official told Reuters, adding that mediators would share Tehran's deadline with Washington and regional states. Iran has separately been negotiating an agreement with its neighbor Oman across the strait over managing Hormuz, seen as a key component of a wider deal, and says they are close to agreement, although progress has been slow. If Oman gets in the way, we'll bomb the shit out of them, Trump told Fox. Houthi attacks stoke concern over a wider war. Thousands of people have been killed in the conflict, mainly in Iran and Lebanon, since the U.S. and Israel launched attacks on Iran at the end of February. Iran has bombed U.S. military bases and infrastructure in countries including Oman, Jordan, Kuwait, Israel, and the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia. Trump warned Americans in a speech at a rally on Friday to prepare for continued high fuel prices as a result of the war, while also saying that after we finish defeating Iran, pretty soon I'll be declaring the Hormuz Strait a territory of the United States. Earlier on Monday, Trump repeated on his Truth Social platform that his main goal was to ensure that Iran never has nuclear weapons. Benchmark Brent crude oil futures. Have surged since the start of the war in February, hitting a peak of $126 a barrel, roughly 75% above pre-war levels, with choppy trade reflecting concerns over disruptions to Gulf oil supplies and shifting signals on peace talks. Brent crude edged up on Monday to around $89 a barrel. Attacks by Iran-backed Houthis in Yemen have also renewed concerns about a widening regional war and the economic fallout it could bring. In the latest incident, the Houthis attacked what they called a Saudi military ship and four escort vessels in the Bab el-Mandeb Strait with missiles, according to the group's military spokesperson, Vaya Sari, on Telegram on Monday. The strait is a strategic choke point connecting the Red Sea with the Gulf of Aden and an important international shipping route. There was no immediate confirmation from Saudi authorities. Canada braces for 50% U.S. tariffs, with negotiations still far apart, by Pramit Mukhajira and Ed White. Ottawa. Canada faces a new round of 50% U.S. tariffs this week that businesses said could cause job losses in some already struggling industries, while complicating broader negotiations over the future of North America Free Trade Agreement. U.S. President Donald Trump last month invoked Section 338 of a Depression-era U.S. law called the Tariff Act of 1930 to impose duties starting on Wednesday on a range of Canadian imports, including wine, furniture, dairy products, cement, clothing, fishing rods, hockey equipment, and some other goods. That provision permits the U.S. president to impose punitive tariffs of up to 50% against trading partners deemed to have discriminated against U.S. goods. Trump's unprecedented use of this power is part of his hardline approach toward trade with Canada since he returned to the presidency last year. Canada is the number two trading partner of the United States behind only Mexico. The tariffs would cover nearly $20 billion of Canadian goods, amounting to about 5.2% of the $383 billion worth of goods the United States imported from Canada in 2025, according to U.S. Census Bureau data. As the tariff deadline draws near, Canada's minister responsible for U.S. trade relations, Dominic LeBlanc, and its chief trade negotiator, Janice Charette, have stepped up talks with their U.S. counterparts. Canada and the U.S. are still far from reaching a draft trade deal, despite regular meetings, LeBlanc told an advisory committee on Friday, according to a source briefed on the matter. LeBlanc and Charette stayed in Washington over the weekend to continue talks. Unlike many of Trump's earlier tariffs, the new duties would apply even to products that qualify for preferential treatment under the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, which has shielded much of Canada trade from tariffs, posing an added risk to Canada's economy. Last month, Trump refused to extend the USMCA agreement for another 16 years, subjecting the pact to annual reviews, a process that is likely to prolong the trade uncertainty which has capped investments and job growth in Canada. Individual sectors could face the brunt of these tariffs, leading to more job losses and lower growth. Canada's struggling wood product sector and the wine industry, already affected by raging wildfires in the country's west, could be hit hard by the new tariffs. Alan Uzelo, owner of Kibiko Limited, a custom kitchen cabinet brand in Canada, said that if the tariffs are imposed, consequences for the industry could be severe. A 50% tariff is simply not something that manufacturers can absorb, nor can we reasonably expect our U.S. customers to absorb it. It could make certain Canadian-made products economically non-competitive in the U.S. market virtually overnight, Ozilua said. small and medium-sized businesses could be particularly vulnerable because many rely heavily on tariff-free access to U.S. customers. If the tariffs come into effect, they will cause massive dislocation for small businesses that rely on U.S. clients and American buyers that can rely on Canadian suppliers, said Dan Kelly, president of the Canadian Federal Foundation of Independent Business. Broader talks at stake, the tariffs would still maintain Canada as one of the lowest tariff rate countries to export to the United States, according to Joseph Steinberg, University of Toronto economics professor. Steinberg said the greater concern is whether another escalation in the U.S.-Canada trade dispute halts talks over the broader USMCA agreement and what happens to the affected sectors. In the macroeconomic sense, the tariffs are actually not that big of a deal, Steinberg said. LeBlanc has met with U.S. Trade Representative Jamieson Greer 5 times, including a virtual meeting on Sunday, in 4 weeks as the two nations seek an agreement before Wednesday's deadline. Greer has pressed Canada over its dairy system and the removal of U.S. alcohol from stores in several provinces, issues that trade experts expect to feature prominently in any agreement. Ted McKinney, CEO of the U.S. National Association of State Department of Agriculture, called dairy the most contentious agricultural issue. It is more than a sticking point, McKinney said. It is probably the major issue. The Tariff Act of 1930 and its Section 338 are best known by massive U.S. tariff increases and subsequent retaliation that economic historians say worsened the Great Depression of the 1930s. Hayden Panettiere, Heroes and Nashville actress, dies at 36, by Ananya Palaskar. American actress and a country music star on the television shows Heroes and Nashville, respectively, has died, age 36, her family said in a statement issued by her publicist on Sunday. The 2-time Golden Globes nominee, was found unresponsive at an apartment complex in Greenville, South Carolina, and pronounced dead at the scene. City Police Department said in a statement her death was being investigated, but there were no signs of foul play. The police said an excerpt of a 911 call showed medics confirming to a dispatcher they were responding to an overdose at the address and trying to resuscitate an unresponsive woman. Her death came only a few months after the May release of her memoir, Reckoning, which recounted the challenges of childhood stardom, trauma around the difficult 2014 birth of her daughter, and her subsequent battles with postpartum depression and alcohol addiction. She was an incredible light and a force of nature who brought immeasurable love and joy to all who knew her, and to the millions who watched her on screen, her father, Alan Skip Panettiere, said in a statement. A former child actor, Panettiere gained recognition voicing Dot, the young princess aunt, in Pixar's 1998 animated hit, A Bug's Life. Her work on the film Red Along album earned a Grammy nomination for Best Spoken Word Album for Children. She shot to fame playing a high school cheerleader with superpowers, Claire Bennett, on NBC's serialized hit Heroes, which debuted in 2006. She also appeared in the 2000 football drama Remember the Titans, starring Denzel Washington. Panettiere earned 2 Golden Globe nominees in 2013 and 2014 for Best Supporting Actress in a Television Series, Limited Series, or Motion Picture Made for Television for her role as Juliet Barnes in the musical drama Nashville. She was also part of the satirical horror Scream movie franchise. Panettiere's most recent appearance was in the psychological thriller Sleepwalker, released in January 2026, playing a grieving mother plagued by sleepwalking episodes. Her colleague and friends in Hollywood reacted with shock and grief on Monday. Viola Davis, her co-star in the 2014 drama Custody, remembered Panettiere as an old wise soul with such a deep heart in a tribute on social media. "Your tests become your testimony, and your testimony becomes your legacy," the Oscar winner wrote. Panettiere is survived by her daughter Kaya, whom she shared with former fiancé and Ukrainian boxer Volodymyr Klitschko. Kaya lived with Klitschko in Ukraine, Panettiere said this year. Her brother, actor Jansen Panettiere, 28, died in 2023 from complications related to an enlarged heart and an aortic valve condition, the family told U.S. media that year. In May, a sometimes tearful Panettiere appeared on the On Purpose podcast to discuss her newly published memoir, which she said she hoped would help others struggling with addiction or postpartum depression. "I finally feel like I have shaken off all of this darkness and this negativity," she told the podcast host Jay Shetty. "And that means I've closed one door and another door is opened, and I can feel it opened and I can feel all the exciting possibilities. I feel like I have a lot more life to live." U.S. Supreme Court again rebuffs Trump in $5 million E. Jean Carroll case by Andrew Chung. Rebuffing President Donald Trump for a second time, the U.S. Supreme Court declined on Monday to hear his appeal of a $5 million verdict in favor of E. Jean Carroll after a jury found him liable for sexually abusing and defaming the former magazine columnist. The justices rejected Trump's request to reconsider their previous decision in June, denying his appeal of the 2023 jury verdict stemming from allegations that he raped her in the 1990s in a Manhattan department store dressing room. Trump's lawyers contend that the trial was unfair. The court order was unsigned and came with no explanation. The Supreme Court rarely grants requests for reconsideration. The justices also are weighing the Republican president's appeal of a separate $83.3 million jury verdict for defaming Carroll in 2019 during his first term as president when he denied the claims and asserted that she lied about the accusations. Trump's lawyers in that appeal argue that presidential immunity shields him from Carroll's claims and that lower courts wrongly decided that he had forfeited that defense. Trump has been battling Carroll, a former advice columnist for Elle magazine, ever since she published an excerpt from her memoir in 2019 in which she alleged that Trump had raped her around 1996 in a Bergdorf Goodman department store dressing room in Manhattan. Trump denied Carroll's claims and asserted she lied both in 2019 and again in 2022 while he was out of office. The case that led to the $5 million verdict concerned Trump's statements in 2022 when he called Carroll's claim a hoax and a con job in a post on social media. Jurors in that case decided in 2023 that Trump had sexually abused Carroll and defamed her, but did not find that Trump raped Carroll as she had claimed. "We are pleased that the United States Supreme Court has declined again to hear this case," Carroll's attorney, Roberta Kaplan, said in a statement. "As a result, the jury's unanimous verdict that Donald Trump sexually assaulted and then defamed E. Jean Carroll is now final and cannot be challenged in any court," Kaplan said. Following the Supreme Court's denial in June of Trump's appeal in the case, Carroll collected nearly $5.63 million from Trump. The payout represented the original $5 million civil verdict, plus interest. In Trump's request for rehearing, his lawyer said that the issue of presidential immunity in the case that led to the $83.3 million verdict that a jury reached in 2024, which the justices still could decide to take up, could impact the 2023 verdict as well. The Supreme Court, in a landmark 2024 decision, ruled that former presidents have full immunity from criminal prosecution for actions taken in office that were within their core constitutional powers as president. The Carroll cases are civil lawsuits. U.S. Attorney General Blanche publicly backs Pirro after Trump criticism over reflecting pool by Robin Respot. San Francisco. U.S. Attorney General Todd Blanche said on Sunday that he backs top Washington, D.C. prosecutor Jeanine Pirro, who was criticized by President Donald Trump for the way she handled a case of alleged vandalism at the Lincoln Memorial reflecting pool. "I absolutely support U.S. Attorney Pirro, as does President Trump," Blanche said on NBC's Meet the Press program. The Trump administration fast-tracked a renovation of the Lincoln Memorial reflecting pool ahead of the nation's 4th of July celebrations at a cost of about $14.7 million. Within weeks, an algae bloom developed and material at the bottom of the pool started peeling off. Federal authorities subsequently charged former U.S. Olympian David Hearn and others with vandalism. In a court filing asking for the case against Hearn to be dismissed, Pirro blamed the reflecting pool's peeling issues on flawed work by a contractor and accused the Interior Department of providing incomplete information at first. Trump subsequently posted that Pirro should revisit her hastily made decision to drop the case. Blanche said he does not fault Trump for being frustrated over the matter, adding that a witness said they observed vandalism. "That's different than whether ultimately we have the proof. I think judging her on a single case because of the evidence that we had is not fair," he said. The White House has asked the Justice Department to examine potential new charges related to the alleged vandalism at the newly renovated pool. U.S. Attorney Pirro is doing a phenomenal job enforcing that, going after anybody who's doing it, Blanche said. Blanche was narrowly confirmed to be Trump's attorney general earlier this month by U.S. Senate Republicans after bipartisan concerns over Blanche's independence. During his interview on Sunday, he refused to say that the Justice Department would operate independently of the White House. "No, I'm not going to pledge that," Blanche told NBC, but said he would act with integrity and prosecute without fear or any sort of favor. Los Angeles gang leader masterminded Tupac's drive-by killing, prosecutor tells jury, by Jack Queen. A former street gang leader orchestrated the 1996 drive-by shooting of hip-hop star Tupac Shakur in Las Vegas in retribution for the beating of his nephew, prosecutor told jurors during opening statements in a murder trial tied to a long unsolved crime that became a seminal moment in rap history. Dwayne Kefti Davis, 63, is charged in Nevada's Clark County with a single count of murder using a deadly weapon. He has pleaded not guilty. Davis is accused of leading a group of men to kill Shakur, 25, who was one of rap's most commercially successful and influential artists, in a drive-by shooting near the Las Vegas Strip. "You will learn that when the opportunity presented itself for retribution, Dwayne Davis made sure that the shooters were armed and ready to execute their plan. And remarkably, you will learn that from Dwayne Davis himself," prosecutor Binu Pasay told the jurors in a downtown Las Vegas courthouse, referring to recent public statements by Davis that revived the long-dormant case. Defense lawyer Mike Sant said that after 30 years, investigators still have very little evidence to prove their case. Sant also said Davis had a habit of talking bullshit and that the accounts he offered in interviews and his book could not be corroborated. And just look at the actual facts. What facts do you have to support any of what KFD said in any of his interviews or the book, Sant told the jury. Shakur's killing heightened the image of violence permeating hip-hop culture and its lyrics during gangsta rap's golden age, stoking the era's East Coast-West Coast rap feud. Police said that after the 2023 arrest of Davis, that he was a longtime suspect in the killing, but that investigators had lacked sufficient admissible evidence to charge him until he began implicating himself in a series of public statements. The trial began before Judge Carly Kearney is expected to last up to 6 weeks. The jury was selected last week. The trial may feature testimony from Death Row Records co-founder Marion Sugg Knight, a former rap mogul who was with Shakur the night he was slain and is now serving a 28-year prison sentence on an unrelated voluntary manslaughter conviction. The shot caller. Authorities have described Davis as the shot caller of a hurried plot to avenge the beating of his nephew by Shakur and members of the rapper's entourage inside the MGM Grand Casino in Las Vegas the night of September 7, 1996. The violence at the casino allegedly stemmed from hostility between two Los Angeles area street gangs, the Southside Compton Crips, of which Davis was the self-described leader, and Mob Piru, which police say was associated with Knight and Death Row Records. They were in Las Vegas to see a world heavyweight title boxing match between Mike Tyson and Bruce Seldon. Davis allegedly obtained the murder weapon and handed it off to two other men in the rear seat of a white Cadillac as they rode around looking for Knight and Shakur's car following the brawl. Shots were fired when Davis and the others caught up with Knight and Shakur's vehicle. Shakur was struck 4 times and died in a hospital 6 days later. Knight, who had been driving, suffered a minor wound from a bullet fragment that grazed his head. Cold case heats up. The murder investigation grew cold for years, but police said statements Davis made in 2018 to various media outlets about his involvement in the shooting reinvigorated the case. Davis said in interviews and in his 2019 memoir, Compton Street Legend, that he was riding in the front passenger seat of the Cadillac and had handed the gun to one of the two men sitting behind him, according to police. Police have not said who fired the gun at Shakur. The three other men in the Cadillac with Davis have all since died. Under Nevada law, Davis can be charged with murder if he took part in the crime without pulling the trigger. In his book, Davis wrote that he was long considered a suspect in the murder of Shakur and a rival rapper, Christopher Wallace, who performed as the Notorious B.I.G. under the New York-based Bad Boy Entertainment label and was shot dead in Los Angeles in March 1997. Although the Wallace killing remains unsolved, investigators have long speculated that he was gunned down in retaliation for Shakur's killing months earlier. Trump orders Pentagon to cut back military exercises with South Korea. Washington and Seoul. U.S. President Donald Trump on Sunday instructed the Pentagon to substantially reduce joint military exercises with long-term Asian ally South Korea, citing the cost of the drills and Seoul's refusal to take part in actions against Iran. Hours before exercises were scheduled to begin, Trump said on his Truth Social site he was not happy that the U.S. had agreed to participate and highlighted his very good relationship with Kim Jong-un, the leader of nuclear-armed and heavily sanctioned North Korea. These exercises are not only costly, but send a signal that is totally inappropriate and hostile to a country that, as long as Donald J. Trump has been president, has been threatening and unthreatening and respectful, Trump wrote. The annual Ulchi Freedom Shield joint military exercises are scheduled to run until August 27th, with about 18,000 South Korean military personnel participating. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff told Reuters the drills started on Monday as scheduled. South Korea's presidential Blue House said it was reviewing Trump's post and hopes that the friendly relationship between the U.S. and North Korean leaders will lead to meaningful dialogue between the two countries, opening discussions aimed at advancing peace and stability on the Korean Peninsula, it said. The allies would continue coordinating on their combined defense posture and military exercises, it said. Responding to Trump's claim that President Lee Jae-myung had refused to join U.S. efforts to denuclearize Iran, it said Seoul was discussing potential military contributions while considering its defense readiness on the Korean Peninsula and domestic legal procedures. A Pentagon spokesperson returned questions on the matter to the White House, which did not immediately respond to a request for details. Up and down relationship, Trump has long sought to end or curtail military exercises with South Korea while clashing with Seoul over sharing the cost of stationing 28,500 U.S. troops in South Korea and their role in securing the broader region. North Korea, still technically at war with the South, routinely denounces the U.S.-South Korean exercises as preparations for an invasion. Pyongyang last week fired a ballistic missile from its eastern coast toward the Sea of Japan, days after a similar North Korean short-range ballistic missile launch. This decision may be part of a larger effort to create a diplomatic opportunity with Pyongyang, as Trump has consistently wanted since coming back to office. Although the haphazard nature of this move is unlikely to make much of an impression in Pyongyang, Jenny Town, head of the Stimson Center think tank's 38 North program, said in an email, "The relationship between Trump and Kim has been a roller coaster for years. Trump has mocked the North Korean leader as Little Rocket Man and threatened Pyongyang with fire and fury, while Kim boasted that he would tame the mentally deranged U.S. dotard with fire. Yet they also took part in 3 months with Trump declaring, 'We fell in love,' after exchanging letters with Kim. None of these efforts led to changes in North Korea's nuclear weapons or ballistic missile development." Even as Trump on Sunday spoke warmly of North Korea, he pointed to South Korea's stance on the U.S.-Israeli conflict with Iran. "While somewhat unrelated, I recently asked the president of South Korea if they would like to join us in the denuclearization of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and they said no thanks," Trump wrote. Exercise shift to simulations. It's unclear how the drills could be cut back, but in recent years they've shifted away from live fire exercises to computer simulated missiles and cyber attacks. Victor Cha, head of the Korea program at Washington's Center for Strategic and International Studies, said Trump may be seeking greater influence over North Korea, as Pyongyang has been heavily engaged in support of Russia in Ukraine. "In other ways to look at this, the other way to look at this, that Trump wants to engage Kim as a way to impede the Russia-NK ties, said Cha. U.S. military officials have said North Korean troops who have fought alongside Russia in its invasion of Ukraine have gained experience from the conflict, while Ukraine said last week that North Korean-made missiles were used in a Russian ballistic missile attack on a steel plant in Zaporizhia. A high-ranking U.S. Northern Command official, Lieutenant General Joseph Jared, last week warned that North Korea had successfully tested intercontinental ballistic missiles with enough boost to deliver a nuclear payload anywhere in North America. Economic factors. While Trump has repeatedly called for South Korea to shoulder a bigger burden of defense costs, a U.S. official this year called Seoul a model ally committed to increasing defense spending in line with U.S. regional strategy. There are also broader economic tensions. A former U.S. official who worked in the first Trump administration told Reuters he believed Trump is frustrated with the intransigence of the South Korean administration in addressing economic issues. The Lee government has repeatedly pursued policies antagonistic to American companies and shown little interest in following through on the historic investment deal with the United States, the official said. The countries signed a trade deal last year to lower Trump's auto tariffs in exchange for Seoul's commitment to invest $350 billion. South Korea has not announced details of its investment plan. The allies have been at odds over a dispute involving U.S.-listed e-commerce company Coupang, which is being investigated by Seoul over a massive data leak. Record early champagne harvest highlights climate change impact on French vineyards by Elisa Darwish. In the Champagne region of northeast France, dozens of workers gathered among Chardonnay vines at dawn on August 14th, secateurs and buckets in hand, beginning the second day of the earliest harvest since records began in the early 20th century. Climate change, such as the record heat and drought endured across swaths of Europe this summer, are testing the resilience of France's champagne industry. Higher temperatures accelerate ripening and produce grapes with a higher sugar content, making it harder to preserve champagne's flavor and acidity. This summer, the Champagne Committee, CIVC, the industry's governing body, which determines harvest dates by monitoring grape maturity, advanced the official start date to August 12th, more than a week earlier than last year's August 20th. There's no August vacation for winemakers, laughed Benoit Valu, 39, owner of Champagne Jean Valu, in the village of Montieu, which produces about 28,000 bottles annually. Behind him, on the sloping vineyard of the south of the Champagne region, a couple of dozen seasonal workers move swiftly along the vine rows. Their faces and arms were covered in dust and glistening with sweat in the early morning sun as temperatures climbed. Vilut's father, Dennis, 67, who handed over the vineyard to his son, said that when he was a child, the grape harvest took place after school resumed. It used to be in late September and mostly in October, a time of year that was still pretty cool, the old winemaker recalled. Back in the late 1990s, if someone had told me I'd be harvesting grapes before August 15th, I would have said, come on, let's be reasonable, he said. Wine producers in other European countries, including Spain, have also begun their grape harvest much earlier than usual this year due to the scorching temperatures. Some fear heavy losses due to the impact of heat and drought. earlier harvests. This year's drought and heat waves have brought additional burdens to a champagne industry already contending with weaker sales because of shifting consumer habits. Vincent Finot, another winemaker in Montauk, obtained special permission from the authorities to begin harvesting on August 6th, the earliest date on record in all of Champagne, after tests showed the acidity of his grapes dropping sharply. "I don't dare wait any longer," he said, surprised by the exceptional earliness of this year's harvest. Rising temperatures have pushed French grape harvests progressively earlier over recent decades, experts said. On average, across all French vineyards, including those in Champagne, the harvest dates have moved up about 21 days over the past 50 years, said agroclimatologist Serge Zaka. "The entire cycle of vines is affected," Zaka said. According to the Champagne Committee, around 30% of this year's crop was lost to spring frost. Heat and drought have further reduced yields. Stéphane Vignon, a winemaker in the village of Verzenay, said some bunches of grapes weighed nearly 30% less than their typical weight. Adapting methods. In anticipation of lower yields, champagne producers have relied on reserve stocks. "We have implemented a system that allows us, in poor harvests, to reintroduce wines that are stored in tanks to replace the portion of the harvest lost," said CIVC co-president Maxime Thubert. Champagne's challenges offer a sparkling opportunity to British winemakers. Southern England's chalky soil and more moderate temperatures, even if trending higher, mirror conditions in Champagne several decades ago. French champagne houses, Tattinger and Pommery, have both made investments. Even though grapevines are historically one of the most resilient species in France, Zaka said they will need to adapt to increasingly frequent climate shocks. "Traditional practices will need to evolve to preserve champagne's acidity and quality within the bounds of the Appellation's rules," he said. "These might include planting more resilient grape varieties and maintaining ground cover to retain moisture." Dennis Velut said champagne might evolve towards wines that are warmer and higher in alcohol content. They might lose a little of that very ethereal, airy, and light character that defines champagne, he said. LIV Golf Ending Season Early Cancels Michigan Event by Frank Pinu. LIV Golf said on Monday it has decided to cancel the team championship that was scheduled to be played next week in Michigan so it can focus on preparing for its next chapter with new investors. The team championship was originally scheduled as a standalone event from August 27th to the 30th in Michigan, but it will now be determined this week at the club at Chatham Hills in Indianapolis, where the season-long individual champion will be celebrated. "By concluding the season now, we can put our full resources behind what comes next and maintain the operational rigor this transition demands," LIV Golf CEO Scott O'Neill said in a press release. LIV Golf said ticket holders for the Michigan event will receive refunds. The Michigan event is the second LIV tournament to be canceled since Saudi Arabia's Public Investment Fund, PIF, said in April that further investment in the rebel circuit no longer aligned with its strategy. Less than 2 weeks later, LIV said it decided to postpone a June tournament scheduled to be held in Louisiana and would explore a potential rescheduling in the fall, but the season will now end on Sunday. Legion 13 captain John Rahm has already clinched his third consecutive season-long individual championship, but the other two spots on the 2026 podium remain up for grabs, with Bryson DeChambeau, Joaquin Niemann, Lucas Herbert, and Tyrrell Hatton still in contention. The team competition will count the scores of all four players on each team every day, culminating with one of the 13 teams being crowned the 2026 LIV Golf Team Champion. LIV has been preparing for its next chapter ever since the PIF said in April that further investment in the Rebel Circuit no longer aligned with its strategy and that it would cut funding at the close of the 2026 season. The PIF has invested more than $5 billion in LIV Golf since its launch in 2022, and the breakaway circuit managed to lure many leading players away from the PGA Tour. LIV Golf has since said it has secured a new lead investor in a deal that it expects will provide a funding boost for the breakaway circuit as it prepares for a future without backing from the PIF. Trump's 2024 grocery photo op now haunts Republicans in the midterms, by Nathan Lane. Bedminster, New Jersey, 2 years after Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump staged a New Jersey press conference flanked by grocery staples to spotlight inflation under Democrats, food prices are still rising despite his pledge to bring them down. The gap between promise and reality now looms as a vulnerability for Republicans ahead of November's midterm elections. Standing between tables piled high with fruit, beef, cereal, milk, and other household staples at his Bedminster Golf Club on August 15, 2024, Trump blamed the Biden administration for sharp increases in groceries. The spectacle, complete with charts showing higher prices, was aimed at undercutting the Democratic nominee, Kamala Harris, and highlighting Trump's central promise he alone could tame inflation and lower the cost of living. 2 years on, higher gasoline and grocery prices are squeezing household budgets and turning the cost of living into the top issue for American voters. Voters now give Democrats a slight edge over Republicans in who they view as better stewards of the economy for the first time in nearly a decade, according to Reuters Ipsos polling. Sheila Carney, a 68-year-old Trump voter, punctuated her frustration with an expletive as she unloaded $70 worth of groceries into her car outside a supermarket not far from Trump's Bedminster Club. The haul was modest, some meat, detergent, and a 12-pack of iced tea. For Carney, the receipt was evidence that the affordability concerns Trump has sometimes dismissed as a Democratic hoax remain a daily burden for many Americans. "This is real. He can say it's not, but it is," said Carney, hospital administration assistant who has delayed retirement while helping pay off her son's student loans. "He hasn't brought anything down." A Reuters analysis of 26 grocery categories tracked by the Bureau of Labor Statistics and featured in Trump's Bedminster display found prices have risen 3.4% in the first 19 months of his second term. That's less than a quarter of the pace recorded at the same point in former President Joe Biden's term, but still falls short of Trump's pledge to lower prices, as surges in coffee, beef, and apples have more than offset declines in items including eggs and butter. A White House official pointed to data on Wednesday that showed U.S. consumer prices barely increased in July from the month before as evidence that inflation is under control. The July CPI report is further proof that President Trump's long-term agenda is delivering. Prescription drug and auto insurance costs continue to fall. real wages are rising and beef prices have cooled, while other household essentials like eggs, poultry, and dairy remains low, the official said. Lack of enthusiasm. A registered Republican, Carney said high grocery and gasoline prices due to the Iran war were among the reasons she had grown disillusioned enough to consider sitting out the midterms, underscoring recent polling suggesting Republicans are less enthusiastic about voting than Democrats. Carney was one of the 17 Republicans an independent Reuters interviewed in New Jersey's 7th Congressional District, a battleground that includes Bedminster, and where swing voters and turnout could prove decisive. The race pits Republican incumbent Tom Keene against Democratic Rebecca Bennett, who has sought to capitalize on voters' frustration over the cost of living. More than half of those interviewed said they were either undecided or leaning toward Bennett. While grocery prices weighed heavily on many voters, complaints about Keene more often centered on his months-long disappearance from public view earlier this year, which he later attributed to depression. Their views on the economy mirror those of other Trump supporters Reuters has interviewed in recent months, who, despite standing by the president, say financial pressures have dampened their enthusiasm for voting in November. That ambivalence presents another potential challenge for Republicans and raises the stakes for the party's get-out-the-vote operation. And that's all the time we have for today. Stay safe, and thank you for listening.